Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week we have the first of many programs from the 2024 American Writers Festival for you. In this episode, comedians Jamie Loftus and Chelsea Hood talk about Chicago hot dogs, comedy writing, and Jamie's cross-country journey to write Raw Dog, The Naked Truth About Hot Dogs, moderated by food writer David Hammond. The following conversation originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
My name is Sonal Shukla, and I'm the Assistant Director of Programming and Education at the American Writers Museum. I'd like to welcome you all to the first of our programs at the second American Writers Festival. Chicago is known for many things, but first among them, it's food. And first among Chicago food is the hot dog. Here to talk about hot dogs, writing, and other sources of comedy are Jamie Loftus, David Hammond, and Chelsea Hood. Jamie is the Emmy-nominated TV writer and comedian who wrote the book Raw Dog, The Naked Truth About Hot Dogs. David is the dining and eating editor of The New City Chicago. Chelsea is a stand-up comedian recently chosen as the best of the Midwest at Gilda's Love Fest. Welcome you all.
Hi. A good place to start, I think, would be for Jamie to tell us what Raw Dog is about. Now, you know it's about hot dogs, but I think it's about a lot more than that. So, yeah, Jamie, if that's cool with you, you want to just give us a little overview, set a context for our conversation here?
Yeah, no, this is so wonderful. Thank you for both coming here to talk about hot dogs with me. Thanks to the American Writers Museum. Thank you for you. I feel like most of my target audience is hungover and not awake, so it's very nice to have everybody here. Yeah, so my book is called Raw Dog, The Naked Truth About Hot Dogs, a title that I'm shocked was allowed.
It is a euphemism, right, or a colloquial term for something other than a wiener in a bun.
Could you tell me what it is? Sorry, I wasn't aware of that. Could you tell me? No, David, unpack it. What is raw dog? What is raw dogging?
I have no idea.
Sorry, raw dogging?
Sex without a condom is basically the colloquial.
Yeah, so when I was choosing the title for the book, which I will tell you about in a moment, I promise, I was like pitching all of these titles and I was getting no's, and then I pitched Raw Dog as a joke, and then it turns out I think that the higher ups just didn't know what that was called, and my editor was in her 30s, and she's like, I just didn't expand on what I was saying, and it worked out, and I like brought it to my parents. I was like, okay, the good news is I'm writing a book. The bad news is it's called Raw Dog.
Which they probably didn't catch on to either, did they?
My mom figured it out. I asked her to sit with it. I asked her to pray on it. And she came back to me, and she is the best. And she was just like, well, I think that without a raw dog, you wouldn't be sitting in front of me. And then I was like,
what a great mom.
It's true. Yeah, it's a very Catholic parent. Catholic parents love to raw dog. That's why there are so many Catholics. But the book is about hot dogs in the general sense, but also specifically at the time I was writing it. I wrote this book in 2021 and 2022. So it was about a road trip that I took trying hot dogs across the U.S. As COVID, shortly after I had gotten a vaccination, but society was not quite open. So that's one section of it. But it's also supposed to be a cultural history of the hot dog, because something that while I have loved hot dogs my whole life and have been told they are this like great American food, my whole life, I was curious about like why has the hot dog become a symbol of America? Like, how do we end up with this weird phallic food as a symbol, of what America means? So it's an attempt to explore that, and also not shy away from like how hot dogs are made, which is horrific. So you can skip that chapter if you want, but it's there.
Now, when we chatted on the phone, I had said to you, Jamie, that yes, the book is about hot dogs, but it really seems to be about Jamie, which is a compliment because
more
she has some great insights and a very quirky attitude, which really kept me reading. I mean, I'm interested in the hot dog history and the regional variations in hot dog, but your kind of off-center, irreverent in a way, and saucy kind of perspectives, I found constantly amusing, not only in Raw Dog, but also in My Year in Mensa and, to a lesser extent, Ghost Church, both of which, mm-hmm. all three of which I really liked a lot.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I think more books should be about Jamie, and but none were. But I mean, I wanted to, because you're a food writer, you're a real food writer. I'm a fake food writer, and so I. It's part of why I'm excited to be talking to both of you, because Chelsea comes from an experience I'm very familiar with, which is doing stand-up, and so I wanted to come from a place where I am a student of food. I didn't want to pretend that I was an authority going in. And so if I'm not an authority going in, what do I know how to do? And that is be, you know, funny to the extent that people agree, and curious about stuff and wanting to actually learn what I'm talking about without shying away from stuff. And unfortunately, because it's a road trip story, or fortunately, I don't know, unfortunately for me, because it's a road trip story, I'm myself, and I have to, you know, bring myself to that sort of narrative, which in the case of this book was going on an extremely masked road trip with a boyfriend who was not a big fan of me. And so it was, so there was a personal thing. So, well, you know, get to know me, you know.
Is that the part that I'm wildly familiar with? The boyfriend that has no interest in you?
Yes. Oh, the nice boyfriend who your parents love, who secretly hates you. Yes. That is, that's, so there was an unavoidable personal component just because it was such a specific moment where it wasn't like I could just go with anybody. It wasn't like I could start and stop because this was, you know, still when lockdown had just been gently released. So we were really, really careful. We were not bringing new people into it. And like everyone here knows, you know, there is a prisoner-like aspect to that dynamic. Mm. I feel like I'm being really hard on him. He's not a bad guy. He just didn't like me.
But he drove across country.
He did. I don't have a driver's license, which is why you can't cut him out of the book. You know, I would sue me if I drove me across the country and was not name-checked at all. So,
you know, you touched on it, and I did want you to read a little portion of the intro, but what kind of research, or how did you research in advance to travel? Because you seemed to go, you came into towns, you had a pretty good idea where you were going, and you got backstory. I mean, I'm sure you interviewed people at the hot dog places, so you got some mm-hmm. backstory there. But how did you go about researching it?
So the way I went about researching it, I've gone about it differently in different projects that I've done, but for the hot dog book, I did a fair amount of research in advance. The one thing that I was absolutely like, I am not going to research before we leave for this trip is how hot dogs are made. Because I knew if I knew how they were made and then I had to eat 300 of them, that would be a difficult lift. It would affect the tone of the book. And so I went into it learning about where I was going, but not necessarily about what I was eating. I was trying to learn about how, like, I was trying to have the sensory experience of eating the hot dog first and then looking into how it's made, and even like if it meant minutes later of talking to someone at the hot dog place after I'd already eaten it. So I did have, you know, the raw experience of enjoying it without coming in with like intellectual baggage of how it came to exist.
I was also curious because I felt, I'm not giving anything away, and I do highly recommend the read because I loved it. I did the Audible version. Also, I don't know if you're allowed to say that in this space. I felt the judgment, but...
yeah, you have like a little like sniper on your
forehead.
Yeah,
100%. All the red lights are just like beaming in. But I loved it because it's also narrated by Jamie, which I think was super fun for me as a comedian to kind of follow that. But I felt like you did have a sort of natural gravitation towards the oldest or like most historic dog spot in each place that you went, and then you kind of like built off of that and let it like spiral from there. How did you choose which places to go?
That was like a deceptively complicated process where I had a list of, you know, I know that, you know, every city has a definitive list of the year of these are the best hot dogs. And then you have to go online and find out where people are actually eating hot dogs, which is not always the same places. So I did a fair amount of research when we knew the cities that we were approximately going to go to, where I was trying to go to a, you know, distinguished, you know, historical spot and a people's hot dog spot. And if it, there was a lot of overlap there, then great. Where it got complicated was this was, it's frustrating that it was this time in history, but it was a lot of the places I wanted to go to either weren't open or had a COVID outbreak and we couldn't go there. And so there was a fair amount of improvisation of like, we had a whole plan. We were going to go to New Orleans. We had this whole sort of hot dog day planned there, but there was a huge storm there and a COVID outbreak and we just couldn't go. And so then we ended up going to Arkansas instead and having this like very weird experience. So I prepped as much as I could. I tried in general, because we were in most places for one day, if we're going to two places in a town, to go to their oldest place and then a place that people really love. And ideally, they're both the same place, but very often they weren't. So, yeah, I'm not a hot dog snob. I grew up eating boiled hot dogs, so I can't be a hot dog snob.
This is just like a teaser of the Audible version, if you're interested. Yes.
It's, and I could see how listening to the audio version would have some advantages. I mean, listening to you on your podcast, she has a pretty good voice.
Comedic timing, some might say.
Yeah.
Thank you. Also, thank you, David, for lending me your book, because I neglected to bring a copy of my own book to this event. All right. Here is the introduction to the book. For a piece of Americana that virtually everyone has been forced to eat in celebration of European colonialism, there is stunningly little written about hot dogs in detail. There are a handful of books written with a swirl of research and love, and the assumption that you would only read a book about hot dogs because you love them. I will relieve you of that assumption. I would like to be a writer who can keep a cool distance from the subject, who can wait like sitting meat and look over at what interests me flirtatiously until it comes to me. That is not what I am like. I want to consume and be consumed by the objects of my desire until they make me fucking sick. I want to puke them back out and rearrange them like tea leaves. I am a terrible flirt and an excellent hot dog eater. Tell me what's interesting about you, and I will put it in my mouth, chew it up, and spit it out later on, never guaranteed to be better than I found it. So think about how you feel about hot dogs right now, and let me know how you feel at the end of this book. If it's exactly the same, I promise I will not write another one. Which is to be determined. My book is about hot dogs because, like anyone, if you ask me a single follow-up on the topic, I feel strongly about them. I grew up eating hot dogs boiled when my dad was left home alone with us. Came of age with hot dogs sitting in a wet cardboard container at the bottom of my free with $75 purchase tote bag just in case. Got fired for tweeting about hot dogs after a cart sponsored by StubHub failed to pay me when I handed out lukewarm bacon wraps after a Bruins hockey game in 2013. My tweet said something akin to, say it with me, fuck hot dogs. It's my understanding that the best makers of and writers about food tell you a story. My grandmother, who is trapped in a mine for 15 years, used to make me this soup. My husband turned into a mermaid and left me for a grad student who made a mean sourdough. Learning how to make ramen at my apartment is self-care, praxis, body positivity, a radical political act, and pottery class. Food is a connector to one's culture in the same way that language can be, something that can launch you back onto your ratty couch during a commercial break where someone's offering you either drugs or a Barbie doll, depending on the year you're airdropped into. The feelings some foods hold rattle in your skull, sink into your bones, and release into your toilet. So I'm going to tell you a story, and you can tell me if it comes out of your plumbing in the same shape you took it in. This is a story about the summer of 2021, when everyone decided the plague had ended, even though people were still dying. The year after, Americans had grown so nostalgic for something bad and familiar to them while locked inside that hot dog sales leapt by more than 100%. This is a story about looking for a perfect hot dog and never finding it, and you should know that this trip doesn't end well for anyone. Did I mention there were two of us at the building at the beginning? Well, there's not now. I traveled thousands of miles with a cat and a dog and a man, telling teenagers across this great nation that I'll have whatever their regular is. I experienced the full spectrum of what it means to spend $75 on a hotel. I fielded questions about the nitrates, questions about the ketchup thing. Hold your thoughts. Questions about whether someone's aunt's ex-husband still works at this stall in North Carolina, which he doesn't because he died. I have had the arguments about whether it's a sandwich. Sure. Whether it's a taco. Why not? Whether there's any truth whatsoever to that study that says each hot dog you eat takes 36 minutes off your life. I don't buy it, and I believe that is secretly funded by Big Lettuce. I've had my ear talked off by business owners in it for love of the game, by children of business owners who are in it out of obligation, by an actual child who runs a hot dog stand and makes them with steak, shout out to the hot dog box in Chicago, by an exhausted teenager preparing the tiniest hot dog I've ever seen and talking with the guy at the grill. I've seen all the signs, the neon signs, the distressed wooden signs, the all lowercase chic font signs that tell you a quirky girl just got her trust fund and you'll never believe what business she's trying. The irrationally angry signs saying you'll have to fucking wait a little longer because it would appear that the workers don't feel like coming to work anymore. I've become a hot dog snob, met a hot dog snob and wanted to walk into traffic, become a hot dog purist, and fell asleep a snob again, all in the space of the state of New Mexico. I've woken up beside them, woken up from dreams of them, waved away sex after eating them, and been reminded of the sex I wasn't having while looking at them. I've seen people of all genders with natural C-cups whip their tits out to watch a group of men nearly kill themselves eating them on the 4th of July. I've seen an old biker and a young biker, either about to fuck or have a lovely family outing, share one with their lips dangerously close to each other. I've seen the machines, the goop, the paste, been certain that this would be the video, the person, the texture, the bowel movement to transition me to Brooklyn podcaster veganism, and never been correct. Hot dogs are the kind of American that you know there is something deeply wrong with, but still find endearing. They're presented to people with no money as a filling and affordable alternative to health, all while people with too much money have found a way to charge $15 for them. Their high culture, their low culture, their sports food and their hangover food, and they're deeply American for reasons that few people can explain, but everyone has been told their entire lives. The hot dog, my hot dog, is the delicious and inevitable product of centuries of violence, poverty, ambition, whispers in the human ears and knives in the throats, shoulders, and legs of cows, pigs, chickens, and if you're superstitious, maybe even the species they're named for. Today, she rolls around at the front of the 7-Eleven, is vacuumed into the gullets of champion eaters, sits beside a flag you are told you love from the time you start to form memories. She is not American at all, and the most American girl you could meet. All marketing, no substance. Book.
Thank you, Judy.
Sweating at the end.
That was good. Thank you very much. Let's get to a meaty issue here. And I felt there were a few events in the book that seemed like constellating events, things that kind of pulled things together and were kind of mini climaxes in a way, or major climaxes. The hot dog eating contest at Nathan's seems like one of those events. And I would like to touch on how it comes that you are so deeply in love with Joey Chestnut, and also why that event is important to you.
Well, David, I'm so glad you asked. The answer is that the Nathan's hot dog eating contest is the horniest event broadcast on television to general audiences every single year. in the United States. It's disgusting. It's pornographic. You should have to, like, prove you're 21 to watch it. It's so gross. I was really interested to go see. I intentionally did not do a ton of deep research before I went. I wanted to experience it. And also, if you say, I'm a writer writing a book about hot dogs, no one gives you a press pass because they're like, I don't believe you, you know? So I had to go in as a civilian because it sounded like I was lying when I said things. But when I went in, it's an incredible experience being there and being close to watching a man eat that year 76 hot dogs and buns in 10 minutes. It was like he was like emitting a chemical that like does not naturally occur on Earth. And if you get a whiff on it, it's like, I don't know, it's like air meth. I don't know what it is. It's really exciting watching Joey Chestnut eat like that. And in a way that when you watch it on TV, while it is exciting, it's not quite the same. Sure. And then when I looked into the history of the competition later on, there it is really weighed down by all of the things that everything is weighed down with. It's weighed down by most prominently gender discrimination and xenophobia and straight up racism. And there was all of these elements to this really thrilling, weird, jingoistic event that was almost everything you would expect. You know, it's like, why is there such a binary applied to hot dogs where women compete on ESPN3, 40 minutes before men are broadcast on ESPN in the middle of the day and they get 20 times the amount of people. Non-binary competitors, you're kind of out of luck. No one knows what to do with you. And that all of the history within this contest that's only been popular for about 20 years is sort of rooted in, if you're a fan of this sport, and it is a sport, in like the 2000s, the main competition was between Takeru Kobayashi and Joey Chestnut. It was a huge competition where a Japanese competitor came to the US, had already popularized competitive eating in Japan, and then went on to popularize it in the US.
May I footnote?
Yes.
I think Kobayashi was the one who introduced the dipping the bun in the water.
Yeah.
As well as the Kobayashi quiver, which I'm not sure you mentioned that in the book. That's where he kind of does a little, to kind of make room for the hot dog, just jostle the food around in his belly.
Kobayashi is like the showman of the century. He's awesome.
And he was, for what seemed to be clearly racist reasons, was... Mm-hmm. Suppressed, oppressed, out of the competition.
Exactly, yeah, where it was a very, and there's a great, that I talk about in the book, there's a pretty thorough 30 for 30 about this, if you're into sports documentaries, because it is a sport.
you insist.
It is. It takes a lot of physical discipline and training to do it, you know? It's like, people just characterize, I don't know why I'm being so defensive, but people just characterize it as like stuffing your face, which it technically is, but they're also, I mean, you're talking about the Kobayashi method, and there's all of these methods that have been introduced that are very unsafe and bad for your body and health. Don't do it. But there is some, you know, it's not worse than steroids. Eating 76 hot dogs controversially is not worse than steroids. But anyways, yes, the Kobayashi popularized the sport and then was essentially forced out the second that there was a white American competitor who could compete with him.
Enter Joey Chestnut.
And that's where Joey Chestnut comes from. And the only reason, and like he will readily admit to this, the only reason Joey Chestnut was inspired to do this is because he saw Kobayashi on TV. So it was just a very disingenuous, racist beginning to the sport in the US.
And a shame too. I always wondered, and thank you for filling in the details, I always kind of wondered what happened to Kobayashi. Because Nathan's hot dog eating contest is the only sporting event I follow with any regularity.
Same.
This is not a huge issue, but you mentioned several times in the last minute or so that it's a sport.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be hard for some people to swallow, no pun. Because it seems like just self-indulgence elevated to a competitive level.
Well, I think of all sports as self-indulgence, you know, elevated to a competitive level. But that's because I think baseball's fucking boring. Like, you know, you're just, I don't know. Like, it is a competitive event that requires physical training and technique that could kill you. And to me, that is a sport. And that advertisers put a ridiculous dollar amount, and that there's fans of and communities around. I feel like that is like what defines a sport as well, is will people come out to see this, and will they get really weird about it? And the answer is yes.
That's one of the things I admire most, or one of the things I admire most about your writing. You delve into these subgroups, sub-subgroups, like the fans around Joey Chestnut, or American spiritualism in ghost churches, or subgroups within Mensa in My Year in Mensa, which I think is really fascinating to look at the mechanics, the structure of these. I mean, to call them subcultures actually kind of suggests they're bigger than they actually are. These are small groups of people that are passionate about something that most of us know nothing about, which is why I find your podcast and Raw Dog, one of the reasons I find them so interesting.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I mean, I am interested in groups like, I mean, I feel like I gravitate towards groups that seem kind of random and seem like they're weirdos hyper interested in one thing, which is often true, but I'm also a weirdo hyper interested in a number of things. And usually if you talk to people and get their personal background and like, why did you get interested in this? Why did this appeal to you? There is something interesting to be found there. And I feel like most of the, or a lot of the writing around subgroups sort of generalizes people, when I feel like the truth is in really taking the time and talking to people and figuring out what brought you here.
I think for me, I went into the book a lot, like how you went into the hot dog eating contest. I went in completely blind. I knew nothing about it. And I just kind of wanted to experience the whole thing. I think my favorite thing about it, and there were a lot of favorite things, there's like a laugh, a paragraph, but, and I'm a comedy snob, as you may not be a hot dog snob. I am in fact a comedy snob. And I found it really, really funny. But I appreciated this sort of time capsule nature of it, in the sense that it really, as a white woman, yikes,
brave.
As a white woman, I felt like so parallel with you, in the sense of, I guess, say you felt this sort of like social responsibility to kind of like, I'm going to do the deep dive on these things and like, why it's, yes, it's a hot dog. Why can some people charge $1 for it? Why can some people charge $15 for it? And I think we make a lot of jokes about like, it's called Raw Dog and it's really silly, but there's this beautiful exploration into the sort of social justice behind all of these things. How much of that did you know was going to be sort of in what this book was about, and how much of it was like seeing the pattern recognition, right, over time play out to be like, oh, this has to be part of this?
Thank you. I guess I knew that that was going to be something that I was going to approach from the beginning. First, because it's really something I'm interested in. I'm really interested in labor issues in particular, like especially with meatpacking. There's so much labor involved, and so many like labor injustices involved. And I had never seen, while there have been many books about hot dogs and many of which I really like, there was nothing that both talked about hot dogs are awesome and in order for them to exist, a lot of exploitation takes place. And like, this is true every time we take a bite of anything, unless we personally raised and prepared the food ourselves, which is very rarely true. I've never done that. And so I wanted to make sure that that was included, because it just felt like, because I felt so hyper aware of it, especially during COVID, where there was a spike in an already horrible, you know, situation in terms of working conditions for meatpacking employees, and that got even worse. It was the, I think, second deadliest job to have during lockdown, besides working in a hospital, was working in a meatpacking facility, because there was an executive order passed by Trump at the time that made it basically that it was open season, and we were not going to close meatpacking facilities. We were not going to put any restrictions on Americans' access to meat, because meat is American, and all of this stuff that is so inherent to like what it means to be American, or whatever the fuck that means, which is part of what I was trying to get at and understand while still enjoying a hot dog, which is impossible. But it just, like, you start to feel nuts when you go through it. But I wanted to, I guess, share what a crazy making experience it is to try to negotiate these two things, where it's like, I will eat a hot dog later today. That's just a fact. That's a fact of many of my days. And also, the way that hot dog came to exist is very, very often reliant on exploitation. And it is a bummer to think about. But with this specific issue, especially because I feel like I lucked into wanting to talk about something that is so lighthearted and silly on its face, that it was important to really take a look into. And then the weird thing about it was that I knew that going in, and I knew I wanted to talk about labor. I knew I wanted to talk about the meatpacking industry and the history of unions that sort of fell apart over the last 100 years. But as I was writing it, the situation got worse between my like first and second drafts, and I had to update it with all of this ProPublica reporting that was going on about, you know, exactly how bad employees had been treated during lockdown. And I mean, yeah, I could, you know, give myself a nosebleed talking about it. But yeah, I mean, especially like the labor issues were really important to me to get out. But equally important was, I think what we were talking about before the show was making sure that reading a book about hot dogs isn't a punishing experience too much, because that feels like bullying. And
well, and that's what I enjoyed about it was very informative. And I felt like, I think a lot of times we're pressured right now socially to be in this constant information consumption phase of like where we're all just walking around regurgitating podcasts to each other, like, did you hear this fact? I heard a fact. Did you hear a fact? And Jamie has a really great way of being like, here's some facts, and then also I would have sex with this man who works at Disneyland, and you're like, what? And it's a fun way to feel super informed, and you feel like, okay, like, I feel responsible in the American sense of, like, I'm American versus, like, I'm being a good American. I'm learning these things, but I still want a hot dog. Like, it took me on that place of, like, I still was like, yeah, I know people have lost fingers, but I still want a hot dog.
2 amputations a week, I think. Isn't that the figure for meatpacking? I think that was in your book.
Yeah, yeah. They're, I mean,
which is amazing.
It's scary. And like, yeah, the state of meatpacking during, it was weird because I was going back to like my high school brain and I like reread The Jungle, right? And a book that I thought I had read in high school, but when I was reading it, I was like, first, I guess I spark notes'd it because none of this is ringing a bell at all. I in fact read it for the first time 2 years ago. But the fact that it's like so many of those questions are the same exact problems we have now, but now we have like surveillance technology. It's all very scary. And at the end of the day, I will often consume this information while eating a hot dog. And like, I don't know. I feel like I was intentionally avoiding reading food writing as I was writing this because my brain is tiny and I was afraid that I would accidentally start, you know, mimicking someone else's style. And I wanted to make sure I was like staying in my own head. But I was reading a lot of nonfiction and I felt like there's this convention with nonfiction writing, especially if it's about something like big and important, where the last chapter is like, and here's how we fix it. We did it. And like, I knew the whole time, but I just told you a bunch of information. And like that, I feel like that's like the podcast sort of cadence that you're talking about, Chelsea, where, yeah, at the end it's like, but I have the solution, and that is why you just paid me $28. And great, but often I felt sort of like condescended to and frustrated by that, because you're like, oh, great, cool. And you knew the whole time, it's that we have to dismantle capitalism. Like, you're just like, great, thank you. So I didn't want to pretend I had answers I didn't, and I didn't want to pretend that I'm better than anybody, because I'm still eating the goddamn hot dog, you know? So, like, I'm like, here's the information I have. I haven't improved much as a result of knowing it, but maybe you will.
We have to talk about the Chicago hot dog.
I knew it. I knew that's where we were going.
No, you don't. We
what was
don't.
That?
I knew that's where you're going. I hate the Chicago hot dog. Yeah, I say it. I'm a Chicagoan. I hate it.
I read to walk the whole audience there. I got, when the book came out almost exactly a year ago, And I did a talk at Haymarket. I was really excited. It was sold out. I was like, great. Chicago's not mad at me. And then I got booed at my own... because of the unkind things I said about the Chicago hot dog, I got booed at my own book release. It was brutal.
I didn't think it was that unkind. I mean, it's clear you don't like them, and you enumerated some of the reasons, like boiled rather than charred.
Mm-hmm.
And you prefer the char dog.
Yes.
So I actually prefer boiled, but I understand that criticism. I mean, it kind of becomes, in my mind, hot dog becomes kind of a different thing when you char it. But you like it.
Becomes better,
thing.
Yeah.
So cool.
It becomes more edible and better to eat and in your mouth. Yeah, that was, I feel like I kept coming, because I grew up eating boiled hot dogs in New England. And I was repeatedly told, like, well, that's a class thing. And you're like, well, no, we had a grill. We had a pan. Like, it's not a class thing. It's a lack of imagination. We had a pan. We didn't have any money, but we had one pan. And that's all you needed to have a better hot dog than I was having my whole damn life. I'm resentful about it.
The way you're describing it, though, it sounds like a very democratic food that way, that you have the pan to boil it in. You don't need to have a grill. Now, mm-hmm. Chelsea, you don't like the Chicago hot dog either.
No, do we have time? How much time do we have? Because, first of all, why is the pickle spear bigger the same size as a hot dog? That makes no sense to me.
Symmetry.
If you wanted to give me a small pickle spear, David, you hold up. If you want a small pickle spear, fine. Tomato slices, get the tomato seed goop out, and then cut up the sport pepper so that I don't have a giant bite of hot in each. And the sport pepper is too many. It's too big. What are we doing? Just give me a hot dog with ketchup only. And I know that that is the least Chicagoan thing about me.
No, oh, I'm seeing some light
agree. It's delicious.
I'm like having PTSD. Look, you're all wrong is the thing. Like, it's at the simple. End of the day, you're wrong and you don't know what you're talking about. I know what I'm talking about. If you want to drop your whole life for a year and try a bunch of better hot dogs, and you should... then you can boo me at my own damn show about it. But I've just had it with you guys. You're wrong. It's mid. The Chicago hot dog is mid. I don't know what to tell you. There's no good hot dog where I'm from. They're Boston hot dogs. I wouldn't recommend it. You shouldn't do it.
Well, we had talked a little before we got up on stage here about how the foods you had as a child.
Yes.
Sirius Eats came up with, I think it's called the pizza cognition theory. Which is that the first pizza you had as a child, whether that was deep dish, thin crust, margarita, whatever it was, that becomes the paradigm, the perfect archetypal piece of pizza that you love, and all other pizza is lesser for not approximating that ideal. And Steve Dolinsky, in his book Pizza Town, Pizza City USA, talks about Pigu, P-I-G-U-E, pizza I grew up eating. He said, that's the pizza you want. Whatever pizza you grew up eating, that's going to become the pizza you want. But you grew up eating boiled hot dogs. I mean, you're kind of the outlier on this theoretical approach. You have shunned boil or prefer not to have boiled.
I'll eat it, but yeah, it's not my preference. But I do think that there's a lot to that, too, because I feel like there's a lot of... I mean, those are like my favorite things to talk about. It's something that people are inherently defensive about that don't mean much on its surface. Like, you know, no ketchup. No ketchup. To some people, I've had a Chicago business owner threaten to cut my hand off for saying that I think ketchup is actually cool. But like, I love that kind of stuff because it's like people are, you know... Why? How do you get there? And it has everything to do with, or very often has a lot to do with how you grew up, where you grew up, and like your formative foods. So while I have diverged from the boiled hot dog, I have nostalgia for it because it like tastes like not knowing anything and thinking that
like
everything's
home.
Yeah. It tastes like not having a problem. Ugh. And any food that tastes like not having a problem is delicious.
Some of those foods we love from our childhood are not the best renditions of that food.
Yeah.
For instance, mac and cheese. I mean, many people, not all of us, have a warm spot in their hearts for Kraft macaroni and cheese. And it does. You can go to Spiaggia and have, a quattro formaggi. Mac, and it won't be as good. It won't hit the right buttons. It's just not crappy enough to hit the right buttons. And with tater tots, too, I've had several chefy versions of tater tots. I don't enjoy them nearly as much as Ore-Ida's, which are, you know, you buy, you know, a 3-pound frozen bag in the grocery store. Not exactly haute cuisine, but that's kind of what it's what I grew up with, is what I like.
It's what my favorite anecdote about that was it's like a Disneyland anecdote where in like the early 2000s, they hired a chef to like improve their corn dog, which was a grocery store corn dog and had been for 50 years. And they spent $100,000 paying this is the guy that I wanted to have sex with at Disneyland.
Oh, I know. I know.
Paying these like hot chef twins to create a sexy new corn dog for Disneyland, and they worked on it for a year. It was very well documented, and they were like, here's our sexy corn dog, and everyone was like, we hate it. We hate it. This is garbage. It was technically way better.
Better ingredients.
Right, but especially in a space that people associate with their childhood and like a previous version of themselves, they preferred the garbage, and I like that. I think that that's like a very kind of like deceptively sweet and vulnerable quality to people. It's like, no, I want my garbage because it makes me feel 7.
It's reassuring.
Yeah.
I think you had a lot of really great like moments of vulnerability, and I'm assuming there's a lot of people who write or want to write in here, and I wonder how you kind of regulate that in your writing. Like, there's these great little moments, and there's sort of a lot of Jamie and there's a lot of Hot Dog, and how do you kind of balance that? How much is you balancing that? How much is your editors balancing that?
I feel like it's a pretty equal relationship there. I had an amazing editor, Allie Fisher at Tor. She was unbelievable and so supportive and also like honest with me when I needed to hear it. Cause I feel like I turned in 3 drafts. My first draft was overly a journal entry. Where I was giving, you know, it was, I think, 50,000 words longer. It included chapters we ended up cutting. Objectively, there was too much of my personal life in it. And, you know, between the first and second drafts, it was like, okay, what am I comfortable sharing? And then what needs to be here in order for the reader to get what they paid for? And then I turned in a second draft where I erased myself entirely from the narrative, and she was like, well, no, let's find a, you know, it was a really, and I think it's because I had a great relationship with my editor that I was able to sort of figure out and negotiate, like, how much of me is, you know, and everyone will feel differently about it, but I was, like, happy with the amount of myself that ended up in there without it feeling like, this is, because I feel like very often you get like, oh, I thought I was reading about this, but I'm actually just reading about some lady. And I don't want people to feel like they've been tricked into reading about some lady, but you are going to read about some lady a little bit because some lady is writing it, right? And so it was really interesting figuring out, like, balancing my journalism brain and my comedian brain. It was like the big boss of negotiating those two, and I was really happy with where we landed on it.
We talked a little bit before about who that person is writing the book. And I know I had this feeling when I first started posting on social media like 20 years ago that I read those things now and it's like, did I write that? Was that actually me? Because I was unconsciously like projecting a persona that corresponds in some respects, but not all respects to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You felt that when you were writing that this person you're presenting in the book, it's obviously the same lady who wrote the book, but yet not identical to. There are some aspects that are maybe played up or played down or shaped in a way to make the narrative more interesting.
Yeah, well, I want to know, because Chelsea, I don't know how long you, like, I know we've both done stand-up for a while. Like, I'm curious how you do that too, because I'm always just interested in, because yeah, I mean, it's like there is a level of persona that goes into it, but it also is like, it's not lying. I don't know. How do you do that when you're sort of switching between normal life and stand-up?
I mean, I'm painfully alone, and I think that's helpful. I don't have to switch on or off for anybody. But no, there is, I think it's true, and I think I would almost, not to be controversial, I would almost disagree with David saying that, like, the exact same woman that I've met over the last 300-400 pages is sitting next to me, and I feel almost befriended to you after reading it, and like, ugh, we got to talk about the relationship. What's the cat? What's going on with the cat? You know, and
he's so good.
See, like I did want to know, but I think that there's a lot of like what I really enjoyed about it as a woman, as a liberal, as a feminist. It just felt like this, like sort of no holds barred. Like this is how I feel about this and hot dogs and people, and like I think there was that really like nice part of that where I felt I didn't have to differentiate between the two of you. I feel like the Jamie that wants people to like this book and like the person that doesn't. But I think you said something interesting in an interview I saw about this book, which is like ultimately we're all kind of seeking the approval of our peers and of like the people around us. And I think that's like the part of stand up where it's just like ultimate validation seeking. I mean, to sit up here for the first 15 minutes of this interview and not speak into a microphone, I was just like glitching out. So it's weird. I think that part of it is really weird and interesting. And I would be curious to see, I would like really look forward to your next book, which I hope you do write, because I would be in line first to buy it. I would love to see like how that personality explores something else. I would be really curious.
Nice. Yeah, I feel similarly where it's like, I feel like the persona, I don't know, it's me. And also the easiest thing is it's me 3 years ago. And so I feel like I can have more empathy towards myself and even like her better because that was 3 years ago. And even when I was touring the book, it was 2 years ago. And I had a little bit of perspective on that time in my life. I understood what my personal failings were at that time better. And just a little bit of distance from myself was like, I like 2021 Jamie. She was doing her best.
She was awesome.
And yeah, what happened to her? She sucks now.
She was on a toilet for most of 2021.
Yeah.
Ready? I think we're getting near the close here.
What happens now?
I brought a clock, which is actually an iPad because I'm 40. I have one more question because I do feel like the like moments like these where we're coming to listen to other people speak about the thing that we want to do. You had these like really great moments with people throughout the book. And I would say like, even if you just read it to read these interactions that happen with these hot dog stand human beings across the country, at one point Jamie calls it hot doggery, which is an adjective I'll be integrating into my life. I think you had a great way of capturing these moments with these people. And I really felt like, oh, I would know how to cast them immediately if this was going to be shot for something. How do you capture those moments in your head and those times, and then how do you like record them and bring them forward later in the actual writing of your book?
I love weirdos so much. Pragmatically what I do is at the end of every day, if I know I'm doing reporting where I am not yet sure what details are going to be significant, I was talking about this with David the other day, before I go somewhere, I'll walk several blocks on either side. I'll take pictures. I'll take notes of like what is near here in case I want to look into what this is later, whatever it is. I will eavesdrop on people. And then at the end of every day on a trip like this, I will do I don't usually have the juice to journal proper, but I will wander around the block of whatever shitbag hotel I'm staying in, and I'll like record a long audio note about here's exactly what was happening this day, here was how I was feeling, here are other things that were randomly on my mind this day, and then, you know, 6 months from now, Jamie will have to deal with what was on my mind at the time. But I just try to document as much as I possibly can, including the stuff that like is embarrassing. And most of it doesn't end up there, which is great. But occasionally it is nice to find a little detail where it's like, oh yeah, and I was getting really horny for this corn dog chef today. Surely that won't end up in the book.
And what do you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was just gonna say, is there anything that you wanna kind of let us know about what's happening in the future for you?
Oh, thank you. So I just started releasing a podcast that is about internet characters of the day called 16th Minute. And it is like sort of in-depth human interest stories about people who were famous online very briefly or moments online that were interesting. I did a 2-hour interview with the Hide Your Kids, Hide Your Wife guy who's originally from Chicago. He's very interesting. And I just finished my first novel, which is about objectum sexuals, so people who fall in love with buildings. And yeah, I wrote a book about an architect who cheats on her husband with a building that she designed. And that's what I'm up to, sorry.
Trying to work out the mechanics of that, but I'll...
Yeah.
Good.
That feels like the perfect way to just absolutely eject from this conversation.
Did you know you can fuck a building? See you later. All right, is that...
Yeah, Sonal, anything... can we stand up? What do we do now?
Oh, no.
Okay, great. We'll stand up. Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.